Europe on Air.
Europe on Air.
Europa por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on Air.
Europe on Air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour program looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday, 4:30 to 5 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Europe on Air. This series will look at aspects of Irish society in a European context and consider the impact of the EU. Today's topic is gender and sexuality, and my guests are Debbie Hutchinson, producer of The Feminist Heart, radio series on the history of feminism in Ireland, Niall Hanlon, lecturer in gender studies and author of Masculinities, Care and Equality, Identity and Nurture in Men's Lives, and Ciara Eustace, press officer from the European Commission representation in Ireland. Debbie, first to you, when you recently made Feminist Heart, looking at the history of feminism in Ireland, what did you learn about the development and the history of feminism in Ireland?
I learned a lot, basically, because I suppose the main active period of the Irish women's liberation movement, those early years, was 1970 to 1978, really. And I suppose I was only a baby at that stage. So what they had achieved had largely disappeared from history. It's not very prominent in the history books, and it's not very prominent in schools' history. I believe that's changed now, and there is a module within history on the Irish women's liberation movement. But I think recently, a couple of years ago, somebody, Fintan O'Toole, put in the Irish Times 10 things that you didn't know a woman couldn't do in 1970. And it prompted a huge kind of discussion on Twitter with people in their 20s and 30s and even 40s saying, we didn't realise how bad it was that a woman couldn't open a bank account without her husband's signature. You know, that women couldn't sit on juries, again, which was a major one as well. And also that the marriage bar was still in place, so that if you were working in one of the public bodies, you had to give up your job when you got married. And it was as simple as that, amongst other things, you know, things like in terms of violence against women or domestic violence, is that there was no such a thing as a barring order. And legally, you couldn't bar a man from his home. So even though you may have been abused by your husband, you had to allow that man back into your house. And actually what happened was that women and the children ended up leaving the homes because their husbands were allowed. And so when you say that to people, and it's the 70s, and I suppose when you think of the 70s, you think of flower power and being very liberal, but it just wasn't the case in Ireland.
So would you think perhaps then many people born after 1970 just aren't aware of this, just weren't aware of these things?
Yeah, I just think they're not aware of them, I suppose, because they did a lot in terms of legislation, like the fact that the marriage bar is no longer in place. And a lot of the founding members of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, they would have gone on to set up organisations like Women's Aid and Cherish. And they did a lot for single mothers and for women that were victims of domestic violence. So I suppose so much happened in that period of time that we kind of forget how bad it was in those days as well. And particularly from a perspective of Europe, is that a lot of the women that I spoke to who were members of the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, they said that Europe was very pivotal in enforcing the Irish government's hand in terms of things like anti-discrimination and pay, and also numerous areas. But I mean, that was one of the big ones in terms of the Anti-Discrimination Pay Act in the early 70s.
And Ciara, if I could bring you in here, I mean, is that right? Is it fit the way the Feminist Heart tells its story, that there was EU legislation and EU directives and those kind of things that played a role?
Definitely, yeah. I think the point that Deborah made just there about, and actually Margaret E. Ward from Women on Air made the same point during Debbie's programme, that the EU was the best thing to happen for women in Ireland. There was a huge amount of progress in a very short space of time, for example, with the Equal Pay Directive, and then later maternity leave rights were introduced, which were also you know, introduced across the member states. And I think, as Debbie said again, a huge amount of progress was made during the 70s. And perhaps women these days aren't necessarily aware of what was done. That said, however, I think a huge amount still needs to be done. So, for example, the gender pay gap.
Maybe, Ciara, before we get into the current situation, just looking at the development part. Niall, if I could bring you in there. Ciara was saying that it has been said that the EU was the best thing that happened for women. Was it a good thing for men?
Well, I think it was a good thing for men. I think oftentimes when the conversation of men comes up in relation to gender equality, the presumption is that it's bad for men. But in fact, I think gender equality has actually been enormously beneficial to men in many ways. For example, over the past 20 years or so, there has been in academia an increasing focus on the lives of men and masculinities. And I think this area of study has benefited a lot from feminist theory and from an understanding of gender inequality. So now, for example, we can analyse men's lives and we have a much better understanding that men are affected in a variety of ways, and that, for example, there are costs to inequality for men, and that there are all whole manner of differences among men that affect men in a negative light. And that's not to say that men don't lose privileges from benefits that accrue to women as a result of gender equality. I think that is the case, but I think that is actually a good thing in terms of equality and a gender balance in society overall.
Okay, maybe again, just that historical kind of perspective. Debbie, were there men who were in favour of equal rights for women in the 1970s? Did they feature?
There were, but they were few and far between, or they weren't very vocal. Having said that, it was quite a radical movement, the Irish Women's Liberation Movement, and I'm not too sure if I was a man I would have ventured in myself now, I have to say. But there were all different stories. A lot of the women were from a middle-class background. They were journalists as well, so their husbands would have been very much in favour. But generally in society at the time, the attitude to the women was quite horrific, like particularly even from TDs and politicians, and the names they were called, and they called them whores and sluts and everything outside the gates of Dáil Éireann. So, I mean, there was a very, very kind of extreme backlash against them amongst men at the time as well. I mean, it was something that men just hadn't seen up until then, you know.
Were there any women actually in politics in positions of power at that time?
No, not that I'm aware of. Mary Robinson was a senator at the time. I think that was the closest it came to. I know there's a lot of kind of figures that are being bandied around in the news at the moment because of the elections that are coming up. But since 1918, there has only been 91 women ever elected to the Dáil, which is a figure that completely shocked me when I came across it, making the documentary.
Yeah, Irish politics, possibly in particular, has been quite a male bastion, if anything. There was a man who was very strong with the suffragettes in 1918 who was shot, I think, inadvertently. Not because he was pro-feminist, I think, because they thought he was a Republican. Sheehy Skeffington. Yeah. I'm getting into places where I didn't quite do my research, but just on the longer-term historical.
Well, I suppose there is a strong tradition of equality and rights for women in republicanism, and a lot of the republican women who were involved in feminism as well, you know, that's where they came from. Like Maureen de Burke, one of the founding members of the Women's Liberation Movement, she was essentially a republican. And she was in the Sinn Féin offices. And it was actually the women from America who came over that they feathered the idea of feminism as well.
So did this research and study, did that make you view the Irish Republican movement in a different way?
I suppose it did, because having been a child of the 70s and 80s, there would have been quite a negative view of republicanism because of the Troubles. But when you actually talk to the women and what they did in terms of equality and in terms of rights even for working class people and all of that work, well, that kind of came to light to me, so I saw another side of it.
So coming out of the civil rights movement in the States and France and Germany and places like that, then the civil rights in the North played a much broader role than just the sectarian thing.
Yeah.
Kira, in terms of what those civil rights would have been, in terms of what people would have fought for at the time, what then today, where are we currently? Are there still major gaps between men and women?
Well, I think to pick up on Deborah's point there about the amount of women who have been elected to the Dáil in Ireland, unfortunately at the moment in Ireland we still are at, we're at 16% of women in the Dáil, and that's among the bottom five of the EU countries with female representation. So I suppose that's one place where we still have a long way to go. And an interesting project actually that the European Commission has supported is Women for Election. And they've been working a lot now recently in, I suppose, supporting and facilitating women to just you know, set up a campaign in the first place. So that's one of the steps we've been taking at the moment.
Can we speculate as to why is politics such an uninviting place for women?
Well, it came out in the documentary as well when I spoke to some of the women who were involved in politics, like Ivana Bacik as well. And one of the main things is that it's the timescale of the Dáil itself is very male orientated, in that it has sittings that are late. I suppose the thing is that women, the majority of women, take care of children. And that's just a fact in society as it stands. So in that sense, it favours the men more than women, because they have late night sittings. There's only recently they've got a creche in the Dáil as well. And obviously the creche closes at 5. So it's not much use if you have to stay in chambers till 9 o'clock at night.
And is it also part of the traditional view that perhaps, Niall, that men... men's identity is still around things like golf and a bar and rugby and these things? Is that why it's a masculine world?
Well, I think men's identity is a very important factor, but I think men's identities have also changed quite considerably also. However, the idea that men are primarily breadwinners and at best secondary caregivers, I think, is still very powerful. So, for example, you find very few men who will give up their career track in order to care full-time for children. And also, of course, we have the whole debate that men and, of course, women have very little options, really, when it comes to dividing up care. Men have particularly bad options. So men institutionally are not expected, nor are they encouraged, to be primary carers in society. And I think that's a major problem for men, and it's a major problem for women also.
And how do we fare? Is there research or studies that shows against our European neighbours?
Well, there's a very new way of looking at equality in Europe. It's measured as the Gender Equality Index. And this index is very interesting, because it looks at a whole range of different countries in Europe, and it measures the disparity between the disparity in terms of equality. And overall, Ireland comes up at about just very slightly above average overall. But there are some areas where we do very badly and some areas where we do not too badly. We do particularly badly in terms of, as Kira already mentioned, in terms of power. And I think that's a major issue. We need to do an awful lot more in all areas. And broadly, what the European average here in terms of equality is about in and around 50-odd percent. So, in other words, we are halfway towards a more equal society. So we have a good bit to go.
Okay. Kira, you mentioned that about 16% of the political representation of women. How does that fare against other European countries?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, it's in the bottom five of the 28 EU member states. And the top performing countries would be, I know Sweden is certainly one, Denmark, and the Netherlands, I think, is a very good example. And they're all up at around 50%. So I suppose it's really looking at best practice in those countries and, you know, seeing what we can adopt from them.
It also came out in the documentary that the way of working in the Dáil and the kind of atmosphere just doesn't suit women in a lot of cases, and they kind of go into it and then they spend, say, you know, they'll spend 5 hours debating this one article. And what came out from a lot of the women that were in politics is they hear women saying after about 4 years, I'm just going to go out and work in community development, or I'm going to do something where I feel like I'm actually doing something. And also in terms of looking at masculinity, I think the Dáil is a very uber masculine kind of a place. I think a lot of men wouldn't want to work in there either as well, I would imagine. And that's what came out, is that it's an uber masculine, uber macho, and there's a lot of games that are played in there. And the women that get in sometimes just go, you know, I don't have time for this. Like, life is too short, basically.
So is there a kind of, apart from what laws might be put in place, is this a very cultural thing? Are the Dutch and the Nordic countries just better at this?
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think it is a cultural thing. I think culture needs to change. We need to change our values and our understanding of the importance of gender equality. But our values and our understanding of the importance of gender equality is also related to the kind of structures that are there in terms of power, and the different ways that we encourage or discourage people from participating in society. So I think they feed into each other. I mean, I do think that a lot of the Nordic countries have had a much longer tradition of working towards gender equality, and in that sense we have a long way to go. But we have come an enormous way, despite the fact that we have a lot of mileage to go.
Kira, we just touched briefly on what inequalities still exist. Can you expand on that a little? Where are women still very much behind men in today's society?
Well, yeah, apart from female representation in national parliaments, another issue which comes up every year is the gender pay gap. And in Europe, it's currently at around 16%. And in Ireland, we're doing a little bit better at 14%.
So does that mean women are generally paid 14% less than men?
Yes.
For the same job?
Yeah, so the way it's measured is it's like the hourly rate for the same work, basically, is the way it's measured.
Okay. Are there traditional male jobs that it's just too hard for women to break into? And do women earn less because they go into areas where the pay is not as high? Is that?
Well, I think it's fairly complicated. I think there's a lot of factors. So I think that would be one of the reasons, one of the factors. Another one of the factors, I suppose, is there's a huge proportion of women studying, for example, education, health, which lead essentially to lesser paid jobs. And, you know, men would traditionally go for engineering, computing, those kind of jobs. I think that's one of the factors. And then I think another really important factor to bring in is, you know, the structures that are set up around care. And, for example, if women want to have children, it, you know, in a family, it's traditionally the woman that will maybe take a break from her career or work part time. So I think there are a few of the factors. And then resulting from that, women would be more at risk of poverty later in life then, because, you know, their pension contributions wouldn't be as much as men.
That is one major thing that came out in terms of discrimination, is that women who give up their careers to stay at home and mind children, that they can be thrown into poverty, and particularly because they don't always get their husband's pension. And it's not something that a provision is made for, or that they think about in a lot of cases. And they end up having to do very, you know, jobs like cleaning and stuff into their 60s and 70s. And that is a huge area of discrimination. You know, why is there not a pension contribution for women who stay at home?
Is there any truth in the idea that currently girls do better than boys at school? Or do girls do better at leaving cert? Do they have better exams? Do they better exam results? Are there more women going into the kind of traditional professions like law and medicine?
I think you've seen that women have done very, very well in education. I mean, if you look at gender equality, it's one of the areas where women have excelled really well. Unfortunately, that hasn't transpired to higher pay and, you know, positions, higher positions in society. So there's certainly an issue about how women's achievements in education transfers into other areas as well. I think that in terms of boys' engagement in school, I think that there's a lot of exaggeration here. I think there are social class issues here for both boys and girls who struggle more in education, and there is an issue in terms of the dropout rate for boys from working class backgrounds in dropping out of school early. But really it's more to do with a disadvantage issue than I think a gender issue. I think it is also true that girls engage very well in the school system, and they see advantages there and work hard and get rewarded appropriately for it.
Yeah, I can't really comment directly on whether or not girls or boys do better in school, but I mean, the figures are there that less women leave school early than boys do in Ireland, and also that almost 60% of Irish women have a third level education, compared to, I think it's around 44% of men. So Irish women are actually the best educated in Europe.
And can some of that be explained by what we were saying earlier, that men still go into trades? Men still are more likely to be carpenters or bricklayers, is that?
Yeah, I don't know. As a mother of three boys who are in the primary school system, I think that there's a lot about primary school learning that doesn't particularly suit boys. And I think that in terms of rote learning, and I think in a lot of cases, it seems to me, just anecdotally, that boys tend to want to focus on what they feel that they're good at and what they feel they're interested in, whereas girls will tend to, and having been in school myself, I would tend to have wanted to perform well across the board and to do really, and that really suits the Irish education system, and it really suits the Leaving Cert. But then I think when boys go to college and they study something they really want to study, that's when they just kind of take off and they excel. But there's something, I think there's something missing in the Irish education system with boys. I think that there's just something there that doesn't suit them. And I know it can be explained as well in terms of class, but there is something there that's different.
Do you think there's something missing in the Irish education system?
I think that there's a lot of things missing in the Irish education system, but I don't think they all come down to gender. I do think that we need to be mindful of what's going on in education, and I do think we need to look at the way that children are taught, and we need to develop new ways of teaching that are more effective. But I suppose my overall comment on this would be that I think sometimes the educational issues that come up in relation to boys, although there is some importance in it, I think overall that they distract from looking at many of the other inequalities that exist in society between men and women, and in terms of for men themselves, you know. So I think it's somewhat of a distraction, I think.
And is the John Waters kind of argument valid that in some areas of legislation, with family legislation and stuff, men are quite powerless?
I think that there are many men in the, I suppose, the who have separated or in the system of courts can feel very powerless. And I think that it's been a very good thing that we have started in the last few years to look at the court system and think about how it works and to think about the judgments that are being made. I think we do have a history of, you know, automatically presuming and considering that women will be the most appropriate primary caregiver. So I think we have a history of that, and I think that we need to look at it. I think more broadly, there is actually quite a problem with the adversarial nature of our court system. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should develop new ways of resolving family disputes. I think the court should be most sympathetic to who is the caregiver, and we need to look at caregiver rights as opposed necessarily to thinking about father's rights. I think we need to look at also what's in the best interests of children, which we don't really do very much at all.
Ciara, with the European Commission, what are they currently doing? What's the current situation? What are they currently pressing?
Well, I suppose the gender pay gap is one of the big things, and that's really, I suppose it's a peer pressure exercise, you could say, in terms of publishing the gender pay gap in each country and promoting that companies might publish their salaries, so everybody knows what everybody is earning, and it's very transparent in that sense. And also there is a proposal underway at the moment to have more women represented on the boards of publicly listed companies.
So if you could have one policy or one new piece of law that would be helpful in that, what would it be? You have to wrap up with this. So,
I don't think I could give you one overall thing, but I think I'd like to pick up on Stephen's point there about the notion of caregiving and how, for example, it needs to be broadened in order, because I think that's one of the underlying issues, that it needs to be broadened, and for, you know, the caregiving and child minding to be distributed equally among men and women, and for men to have parental leave, and for it not automatically to fall on women.
And Niall, if there was one thing that you could change?
Well, actually, it would be the same thing. I think that we, broadly speaking, need to look at the way people care in society, and we need to include men in this. And I think there's a whole range of different ways that we can approach it and things that we can do, but we could start very definitely by introducing parental leave and paternity leave, actually, in particular. That would be a good start, and to build on that from there on.
Debbie, I'll give the final word to you.
Yeah, the same, paternity leave. I think only when, you know, a man and woman go in for a job together and the employer knows that that man has an equal chance of leaving when they have a baby as the woman does, that's the only way it'll be equal. So I think paternity leave is really important as well. And just quickly, in terms of, we were talking about the gender pay gap as well, is also in terms of traditionally feminine roles like nursing. I think it came out in the light of the HSE scandals about the wages, was that the head of finance got 150,000 per annum and the head of nursing got 80,000. And that's not necessarily a female issue. It's about traditionally feminine roles being undervalued as well in society.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there for this week. Thanks very much to Debbie Hutchinson, to Niall Hanlon, and to Ciara Eustace. Tune in next week, where we'll be looking at the topic of language and folklore. Until then, slán agus beannacht.
Europe por las ondas.
Europa auf Sendung.
Europe on air.
Europe on air. Near FM's new weekly half-hour programme looking at themes including migration, education, mass media, religion, agriculture, gender, environmental policies and much more. Tune in every Thursday 4:30 to 5 p.m. Europe on Air radio campaign has been financed by the European Union. The contents of the radio shows reflect only the author's views, and the Commission is not responsible for any use that may be made of the information they contain.